Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable from now until 4 o'clock, about an hour and a half away. And what a fascinating show I've got in store for you. Before we get to that, just a quick reminder that on this show we discuss issues like, does God exist? Can we trust the Bible? What do we say to those who object to the Christian faith? Well, we'll be addressing those in some depth, not only here on the programme, but at a special conference just now, 3 weeks away. And if you've been thinking about booking in, but you haven't got round to it yet, now's the time to do it. Go online and do book yourself in for Unbelievable, the conference 2012, happening on Saturday, the 26th of May in the Clapham Junction area. So the way to do that, premier.org.uk/reasons. You can book yourself in. Tell your friends as well. Why not let your church know about it if they don't already know about it? premier.org.uk/reasons. And check out the video that's at that page, just to give you a taster of what's coming up at the conference, because we've got some fabulous speakers who are going to be giving us good reasons to believe in a sceptical world. And we're doing it, of course, in partnership with Reasons to Believe. They are providing Hugh Ross and Ken Samples, coming over from the States as speakers, but John Lennox will also be speaking, Krish Kandaya of the Evangelical Alliance. We're going to have Michael Green, who's been a missioner for many, many years and a great speaker on apologetics. We're going to be hearing from Bonnie Yule Kuhn from the Alpha Course, and various other seminars will be going on, a wide range of things to choose from. So you don't want to miss it, basically. If you're into evangelism, if you're into apologetics, if you're into theology, this is the conference to be at. premier.org.uk/reasons to book in for Unbelievable, the conference, Saturday the 26th of May. And one of our keynote speakers, Hugh Ross, is one of my special guests on today's programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we've got another fascinating discussion for you today on the universe. As I mentioned last week, it was Lawrence Krauss and Rodney Holder talking about whether we can get a universe from nothing. Well, today we're asking, why is the universe the way it is? And this will, of course, bring in aspects of what we were talking about last week. But my guests for this week are Hugh Ross and Paul Davies. Hugh Ross, founder and president of Reasons to Believe, an astronomer and a scientific apologist with a lifetime passion for showing how ongoing research supports, in his view, the truth of Christianity. Paul Davies is an English physicist, writer and broadcaster, currently out in the States, professor at Arizona State University, the author of many popular books on the birth of the universe and its special characterizations that make life possible. And we're privileged to have you both joining me today, gentlemen. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on and talk about some of these aspects of the universe today. Let's start with you, Paul, and we'll come to Hugh in a moment's time. Paul, last time you joined me, we were discussing your book, The Eerie Silence, where you were looking at the possibilities of life on extraterrestrial planets and whether we could ever conceivably contact them if they did exist and that sort of thing. But just take us back to your own journey thus far. What made you get into astrophysics in the first place?
I suppose from very early childhood I was fascinated by things that we can't see. I grew up in North London in the austere post-war years where there wasn't a lot of fun going on. Vacations were too expensive, toys were limited to a few pigs and things. But I found that just by looking up at the sky, there was a wonderland there of things seen and unseen, and I learned also about electric fields and atoms and invisible things. I just became fascinated by this sort of hidden reality that could nevertheless be accessed by using brain power. And so I was hooked from a very early age. And I was always interested in what we might call the big questions, the really deep issues, issues like free will and determinism and the beginning and the end of the universe and whether space went on forever, why was I living now? All those things troubled me as even before my teenage years and certainly in my teenage years. And I resolved to become a theoretical physicist and specialise in astrophysics and cosmology. And that's exactly what I did. I sometimes say that all teenagers lie awake at night fretting about these big questions, but then most people grow up. Well, I never grew up.
I like that. Very good, very good. I mean, Paul, you say that these are the questions that have always interested you. Do you, personally, has your views and the research you've done led you to any kind of belief that there is something more than just this physical universe? Is it simply something you put down to a mystery? Are you agnostic on that front?
I don't like the idea of mystery. I don't like the idea that there's anything that is permanently closed off from human inquiry in principle. Of course, in practice, science is an expensive enterprise. There are things that we may never know because we can't afford to probe the phenomena concerned. But we've been doing very well indeed. And I'd like to think that the universe is thoroughly rational and comprehensible. But science, of course, can only deal with what's there. And part of the problem in this whole business of trying to sort of figure out what the ultimate nature of reality might be is it leads us into speculating about things that might have been but aren't. In particular, to be a scientist, you have to assume that the universe is ordered in a rational and intelligible way. And this is normally encoded in what we call laws of nature, or as I prefer to think of it, laws of physics. And scientists simply accept those laws of physics for what they are, because trying to explain the laws is something that, strictly speaking, lies outside the scope of science. Scientists accept the laws and get on with the job of exploring the universe with those laws. And this takes us immediately to the heart of the matter about whether the universe can come from nothing or whether you need to assume something, and you do need to assume something, you need to assume that there are laws. And the question about where do those laws come from may simply be beyond the scope of science. I hope not, but at the moment they have to be accepted as a package of marvels that just happen to be. And that's the scientific position.
Well, it'll be interesting to get both yours and Hugh's view on exactly what your response is to the latest crop of publications, including Lawrence's that we were looking at last week, that do claim to have found a scientific view of how the universe came into being from nothing, as it were. But let's introduce at this point Hugh Ross, who joins us also on the line today. Hugh, looking forward to having you over here in the UK in May. We've been mentioning many times that you're going to be one of our keynote speakers at Unbelievable, the conference 2012. But you'll be talking about cosmology and what you believe are some of the reasons that modern science does uphold belief in a creator God. Tell us a little bit, though, for those who maybe haven't listened to you on previous occasion, of your background and how you stepped into the world of astrophysics yourself.
Well, my story is very similar to Paul's. I mean, it all started when I was 7 years of age, wondering why the stars were hot, going to the library and finding out quite a bit, and then getting intrigued by everything else that was up there in the heavens. I knew from the age of 8 onwards that astronomy would be my future career, and it's been a passion I've had ever since. And, you know, like Paul, I'm intrigued by the big questions. Why do we have a set of rational laws of physics? And the very fact that they are rational and logical and seem to explain everything, I think, tells us a little bit about where indeed they must have come from. And so, but I think it's not just people like Paul and me. I've noticed that everyone that's breathing, a human being, has these questions. You know, who am I? Why am I here? Why is the universe here? What possible purpose does it serve? What is my purpose within the universe? So these are questions that everybody wants to ask.
Tell me, as we look to this question we were looking at last week, could a universe arise from nothing? You've read and indeed reviewed Lawrence Krauss's book on that subject. Just in a nutshell, what did you make of his arguments and his view that you can get a universe from nothing?
Well, I tried to write a review that would be helpful for lay people, and I started off by making the point that, you know, whenever a physicist talks about nothing, it's always something. And so I kind of laid out six different definitions that physicists have for nothing. And I think that's helpful because, you know, nothing can be simply empty space, but empty space isn't nothing. Space is actually something. And, you know, it was Einstein that told us that we can take energy and make matter of it, or matter and convert it into energy. And in some respects, the principles apply to space and time itself. And, you know, when I read Lawrence Krauss's book, you know, a lot of people think he's promoting an atheistic worldview, but he's quite explicit in the book in saying, I can't deny a deistic worldview at a minimum. There's got to be something that explains where these laws of physics come from. So I think his main attack against Christianity is the idea that there's a God that's out there that's personal and that actually cares for what exists within the universe. And that's something I see also in Stephen Hawking's writings, is that, you know, God's one thing, but a personal God is quite something else from their perspective.
Mm. I wonder if you're obviously a colleague in many ways, Paul, of Lawrence, both at Arizona State University. But I get the feeling that you don't quite have the same approach when it comes to dealing with these ultimate questions. Do you believe that everything can be reduced to a kind of a scientific explanation of these deeper things?
Well, first I should say that Lawrence is not only a close colleague of mine, but he's in the next office. And so we see a lot of each other and we have overlapping interests. And we do have a different take on these things. But I think what is really important to understand when you're discussing, say, my point of view or Stephen Hawking's or Lawrence's or anybody else's, is that we all agree pretty much on the science. Mm. So it's only a question of what can that science do for you. And one thing that's in Lawrence's book, has been in many books previously, is simply pointing out that given the laws of physics, if we accept something like, say, quantum mechanics, which enables things to pop into existence, so to speak, spontaneously, without a well-defined prior cause. If we have the idea of space-time that can come into existence where there was no space-time before, which is something that Einstein gave us 100 years ago, if you accept those things, then, of course, you can develop a narrative in which the universe of space, time, matter and energy comes into existence, does exist now, whereas it need not necessarily have existed in the past. And two things I need to say here. One is the point that we've already made, both you and I, which is that you can only develop this narrative if you assume that the laws of physics and specifically quantum mechanics and the general theory of relativity and a whole host of other things are already somehow there. Mm. That doesn't mean that they... it's really important to distinguish between a causal chain and an explanatory chain. When we're talking about causation, people always want to know what made the Big Bang go bang, what was there before the Big Bang, because we're used to the idea of cause and effect, that a cause comes first and the effect comes afterwards. When you're dealing with the ultimate origin of all things, then that really breaks down. But there's a different sense in which we can try to approach the world and describe it in this way. We can say, can we explain the world? So there can be an explanatory chain, and this explanatory chain for Lawrence stops at the laws of physics, which have to be accepted. Now there's a refinement, a twist to this, which confuses a lot of people, because it's not clear that the laws of physics that we have in our textbooks are, as it were, the ultimate laws. What the feeling these days is that as the universe cooled from the Big Bang, the set of sort of truly fundamental laws differentiated out into what are effective low-energy laws that operate today. So the laws that we know and love, say, in the lab, are not, as it were, the ultimate laws, that if we could heat the whole universe up again, we would recover these ultimate laws. And it's fashionable to suppose that if there were other Big Bangs, the universe might cool in a different way and get different low-energy laws. You might think, well, therefore, we've explained how the laws of physics come to exist, but we've only explained how these low-energy effective laws have emerged from these sort of meta-laws or super-laws, which would apply at these higher temperatures. And so you still have to assume that there is some sort of meta-law overarching everything. Mm. And at that point, the scientific explanation stops unless we extend science to incorporate an explanation for the laws. Very few scientists want to do that, though it's not logically impossible that we could attempt to do that. Now, having said all of this, there's an alternative way of looking at the universe these days, which happens to be more fashionable. It doesn't make it right. the pendulum has swung, and that is that the Big Bang was not the ultimate origin of all things. It was simply the beginning of our own particular bubble universe. And what we've been calling the universe all along is just an infinitesimal fragment in a much larger and more elaborate, indeed infinite, system that is called the multiverse. And that this overarching multiverse is eternal. It has no beginning or end. And our universe is just one representative or one bubble in that multiverse. This still doesn't solve the problem of existence because you still need to say, well, why does the multiverse exist?
Yes.
It may not have had an ultimate origin in time. It doesn't explain why it exists or why it has the form that it does.
It pushes
left with a mystery.
It pushes the problem back, as it were. I mean, Hugh, right. do you concur with this, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to Paul, and it's something that we astronomers all would agree on. It's not incompatible with the Christian faith either. The Christian faith has always been stating that there's a space-time beginning from which the universe arises, and that God exists beyond space and time. He's the author of space, time, matter, and energy. And the Bible tells us that he did create other realms, so the multiverse is not antithetical to Christianity. After all, you got the realm of the angels, according to the Christian faith. But the question is, this causal agent or God, what characteristics must he have? And, just following through in the principles of cause and effect, that causal agent's got to be bigger than us. And so that's one reason why I'm a little disturbed by some of the philosophical thinking of people like Lawrence Krauss and Stephen Hawking, where they claim that the causal agent, the cause of the laws of physics or the multiverse, has no mind, no personality, no intellect, no knowledge, and yet we exist, us human beings, who have intellect, emotion, and knowledge, and spirituality, personality, and consciousness. So how can that which is conscious come from that which is not conscious, or that which is thinking come from that which is not able to think? And so in that sense, I think we can get at least some kind of a handle about what the characteristics of the ultimate cause must be.
Well, it would be good to tease that out a bit. Let me, before we do that, say if you're listening and you'd like to comment on anything you hear on today's programme, I do welcome your emails, and we'll hear some of your responses to last week's show with Lawrence Krauss towards the end of today's programme. If you want to do that, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can also, of course, find us online on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Tweet me at unbelievablejb as well if you want to share your thoughts that way, and I'd be pleased to interact on those forums. Don't forget all of today's show available, including links to my guest, to Paul Davies, where you can find his books, and Hugh and the Reasons to Believe, and indeed the conference details, all available from premier.org.uk/unbelievable. So do check out there if you want to find out more about today's show and indeed previous shows that both Hugh and Paul have appeared on.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Paul, what Hugh had said there, this idea that you can't get the thinking from the non-thinking, or it's hard to see how that happens. I know that the way that your colleague Lawrence would see that is that, well, philosophy—that's philosophy, Hugh. You know, that's kind of we've surpassed that now. He's very dismissive, actually, of philosophy in general. Where do you see it? Do you think Hugh's got a point there about the cause of the universe has to, in some sense, at least have a sense of personality for us to have a sense of personality and meaning and the rest of it?
Well, first of all, I said I don't like the word cause in this connection, because it does imply something that is that prior in time. And it seems to me that if the starting point of science are these magnificent laws or meta-laws or whatever we're going to say, then if you want to appeal to something like a god who ultimately is supporting those meta laws, then this god is outside of time. So now the question, let me come to the question about whether purpose or mind or consciousness or something is there at the bottom of the explanatory chain, or whether it's something that emerges. So a lot of scientists, and I have some sympathy with this, subscribe to a philosophy called emergence, which means that at successive levels of complexity, new qualities or properties emerge, which are simply not there at the bottom level. Classic example is no atom of my body is alive, and yet I am alive, and I believe it is meaningful to talk about a system being living and having properties and qualities of living, and yet none of its components are living. And so this is one example of emergence. Life is something that emerges at some level of complexity. And I think probably most scientists feel that consciousness, which is still a deep mystery, is something connected with emergence. That is, it emerges at some level of neuronal complexity, which we haven't yet pinned down. This is just an act of faith at this stage, because we don't know. And, of course, there's a long tradition in philosophy that mind might be something more fundamental in the universe, might be part of the input and not just part of the output. I'm a bit agnostic about this. What is undeniably true is that when we look at the deep fundamental laws, these wonderful laws of physics we've been talking about, these laws do seem to be elegant, mathematical, economical, rational relationships. I'm not sure that's quite the same as mind, but it's getting close to it. So I suppose when it comes to words like purpose or any of these human qualities, we have to be a bit careful about projecting onto nature things that come from human nature. So human beings undoubtedly have purposes, we have goals, and when we look at the universe, we can see a sort of an analogy in the way that the universe develops. But maybe it's no more than an analogy. But analogies are okay, and I often say, almost all scientists are perfectly comfortable with the idea that the universe is a mechanism. Newton had the notion of a clockwork universe, so the universe as a mechanism doesn't ruffle too many feathers, and yet a mechanism is really a human construct as well. We build machines, and we think, oh, the universe is like a machine. If you look at the history of human thought, we see that each age has had its own metaphor for the universe. So for the Greeks, they thought it was the pinnacle of musical harmony and geometrical relationships. And then for Newton, it was a clockwork. And then along came the steam engine and the heat engine. And then we thought the universe was a sort of gigantic heat engine running down. And these days, people say it's like a computer. It's processing information. These are all metaphors. And I think the metaphor of the universe being sort of like a biological organism having purposes, it's a useful one, but all of these metaphors I've been talking about are not the ultimate reality. They capture some aspect of reality. And if we're going to talk about some sort of, I don't really like the word God, I'm not comfortable with it because everyone has a different meaning, but if we're going to talk about some sort of ultimate explanation of things, then I would say that it would be something that would transcend all human categories, all human attempts to capture it. And so trying to squeeze this God into a sort of human-like personality, I think, is too limiting.
Limiting in that sense. That's interesting. Right. Hugh, response from you on that.
Sure. I've read some of these books on emergent complexity, but there's limits to what you can do with that emergence based on the laws of thermodynamics. Laws of thermodynamics tell us that things tend towards disorder and lack of complexity rather than the other way around. And what I'm noticing in some of these books by Lawrence Krauss and Stephen Hawking is a persistent claim, for example, that we have solved the origin of life problem from a naturalistic perspective. And in fact, all we've done is demonstrate how clever we are in our sophisticated biochemistry labs at duplicating some of the chemical pathways that would be critical for the origin of life. But the truth is, these are largely irrelevant to the early conditions of the Earth under which life emerged. And so it's simply not correct that the origin of life problem has been solved from a naturalistic perspective. In fact, it looks like, based on our laboratory experiments, we're going to need a causal agent that's got a lot more intellect and education and funding than what these biochemists have been able to do in the lab. And likewise, I see that with some of the analogies that, again, I saw in both the writings of Krauss and Hawking, the idea that the discovery of extrasolar planets is proving that there's nothing special about our solar system. When if you look at the Exoplanet Encyclopedia, what's coming through is just how unique the characteristics of our solar system planets are relative to what we see elsewhere. And in looking at the uniqueness of the characteristics of our eight planets, we're discovering how fine-tuned they all must be in order to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth, which is something I saw at the Skeptics Conference at Caltech in 2008. As a consensus even amongst those who take a non-theistic perspective in physics, that it looks like we human beings are alone in this vast universe, given the degree of fine-tuning that's necessary for advanced life to be possible.
I mean, this is something obviously you're familiar, very familiar with, Paul. You wrote The Goldilocks Enigma, looking at, in a sense, what it took to get us here. Do you obviously don't feel able to take it to the level that Hugh obviously takes that as firm evidence of an intentional design, let's say, for us, that the fine tuning and the parameters within which we exist and the fact that we live on a habitable planet that has all these qualities that make it ideal for life to develop, indeed make it possible to do science in the way that we do it. For you, does that carry you far enough to a kind of a purposive creator behind all that, or is it simply too much of a step for you to go there?
Well, we've got a lot of ideas all muddled together, so let's try and separate them. First, I agree completely with Hugh that the problem of life's origin is not solved, and it's quite ridiculous when scientists give the impression that we're just sort of on the verge of figuring out how life came to exist. We don't know how it came to exist, and that makes it impossible to put any odds. We know that there are many Earth-like planets out there, plenty of real estate on which life might emerge, but there's no way we can compute how likely it is, given an Earth-like planet, that life will obligingly pop up. When I was a student, it was generally assumed that life was a stupendously improbable accident. I think Francis Crick summed it up very well when he said that to a thinking man, life seems almost a miracle, so many are the conditions that are necessary for it to get going. Today, the pendulum has swung the other way, and it's fashionable to say that the universe is teeming with life, that it comes into existence very easily, given Earth-like planets. I think we absolutely don't know. But where I part company with Hugh is this, that just because something has not yet been explained by science doesn't mean we need a miracle. This is the so-called God of the gaps fallacy, which theologians rejected over 100 years ago because it's a hostage to fortune. It may be that in the future we do figure out how life came to exist, and it's entirely likely we'll make it in the lab. If that mystery goes away, well then it's tough on poor old God who was supposed to be there to bring life into existence. So I wouldn't want any sort of God who pops up from time to time to plug the gaps which happen to exist in our scientific narrative at this time. So for me, questions of meaning or purpose in the universe are at a much grander level, not on the level of some specific process.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to get a response by Hugh to that, but I'm going to do that after a short break because just running out of time on this section of the program. You're listening to Unbelievable. Two great scientists with me today, Hugh Ross and Paul Davies, and we're hearing a conversation on why is the universe the way it is. We've got into the area of fine-tuning, into the origin of life now, and I'll again remind you of how to get in touch if you'd like to have your say in the course of today's programme. Join me again after a short break, and we'll be back with Hugh responding to what Paul had to say just there, and we'll also be hearing the response of both Hugh and Paul to a survey we conducted recently on what the British public think about the origin of the universe. So we'll be hearing all that in just a moment's time.
Find out how to share your Christian faith effectively and the reasons why science, history, and scripture all point towards Christ. Join me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable the Conference 2012 with guest speakers John Lennox, Krish Kandaya, Michael Green, and from the US, Hugh Ross and Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe, our conference partner. So learn how to give a skeptical world real reasons to believe. Unbelievable the Conference 2012 on Saturday the 26th of May in London. Book now at premier.org.uk/reasons.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable as we continue to ask today why the universe is the way it is. Hugh Ross is a founder and president of Reasons to Believe. He's a Christian and astronomer, and he believes that the universe exhibits evidence of a creator God, and that the advance of modern physics and astronomy has only served to reinforce that. Paul Davies is an English physicist. He's a writer, broadcaster, professor at Arizona State University. Offices right next door to Lawrence Krauss, who we had on last week on the show. And Paul describes himself as agnostic as far as the ultimate question of what lies behind, let's say, in an ultimate sense, the universe and its laws. But Paul did criticise you there, Hugh, just at the end of that last section. He feels that any attempt to say that God did it when it comes to complex things which we haven't understood, how they could have arisen in a naturalistic way, like the origin of life, is perhaps in danger of committing the God of the gaps fallacy. So what's your response to that? What if we did come to, you know, get a pathway, even if it may be a long way off, for the origin of life?
Well, you know, God did it or God didn't do it. God exists or he doesn't exist. And this is where I think gaps can be brought to bear to put to the test different philosophical perspectives. We're never going to eliminate all the gaps. There's always going to be lack of understanding and knowledge on our human part. But the wonderful thing about human scientific endeavor is we're always learning more. Our understanding and our knowledge base is growing with respect to time. And we can use that growth in the human knowledge and understanding to determine, are the nature of the gaps growing or the God of the gaps growing with respect to time as scientific research advances? I mean, to be specific here, say from a theistic perspective, are the gaps getting bigger? Are they getting more numerous? Are they getting more problematic? Or are they getting smaller and less numerous and less problematic? And is the explanation getting more consistent with respect to the scientific data as scientific knowledge advances? Or is it the other way around? And I think we can apply this test to any discipline of science and ask the big philosophical question. So in that respect, I don't think philosophy is dead. I think philosophy, theology, and science can live together. And by integrating the three disciplines, we can put to the test different theological perspectives. And so if I think the origin of the universe, the design of the universe, or the fine-tuning argument, or the origin of life are excellent examples where we can look at the nature of the gaps and the God of the gaps and say, which way is the trend line going?
So just to flesh that out, because with the origin of life, say, as we've that was specifically what Paul picked up on as him being uncomfortable with God is the best explanation for that. We don't want to go to miracles if we don't have to, as it were, in science. I mean, is it because you feel that the nature of the gap there is such that design, in that sense, is a good explanation for the gap? It's not just a God of the gap, as it were, a kind of, we don't know what it is, therefore we're going to just say God did it. Rather that you'd think that, no, this is actually a good explanation because it's an explanation we use in other areas of science.
Well, I find an interesting contrast when you attend a scientific meeting on the origin and history of the universe compared with the origin and history of life. I mean, the case of astronomers going to a meeting, what we've been discovering over the past 50 years is that evidence has been accumulating for a hot Big Bang inflationary creation event for the universe with an actual beginning of space and time, which is consistent with what the Bible has always predicted about the universe, namely that the universe indeed is traceable back to an actual space-time beginning where there's continuous expansion. I mean, one factor that brought me to faith in Jesus Christ was that the Bible had predicted thousands of years ahead of time that we do indeed live in a continuously expanding universe with constant laws of physics, with a space-time beginning, where the whole universe is dominated by a law of decay. And the progress of the past 50 years of cosmological research has been every year strengthening those biblical conclusions. But when you go to Origin of Life meetings, and this is something that my colleague Fuzz Rana here at the Reasons to Believe, he's our staff biochemist, and myself, as we go to these Origin of Life conferences, what we see is that each successive conference, the mood is more depressing in the sense that they realize that they're encountering greater difficulties than what they had in the past in trying to explain the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective. And so the gaps in their explanation are getting much more problematic as the frontiers of scientific research advance. So those are two contrasting examples where I can see this testing between the gaps on both sides. You know, where are the gaps getting closed and where are the gaps getting wider?
Be interested in your response to that, Paul, and then we'll move on to another of our areas that we're going to try and cover in the rest of the program. But do you accept Hugh's analysis of the situation there, that the gaps are becoming more problematic in the issue of origins of life?
I think the gaps are pretty huge. There's a bottom-up and a top-down approach. The bottom-up approach is people who try to cook up the building blocks of life in the lab, and they've had some very limited success, but you soon get stuck. And then there are the people who start out with the simplest living thing and try to sort of strip it down to its bare essentials. And the gap between going up and coming down is enormous. So I think the problem is that we haven't even grasp the correct concepts for describing what it is when we talk about the transition from non-life to life. And I actually have a postdoc funded by NASA. Her name is Sarah Walker, and we have a lively project trying to capture in a mathematical model how we can describe this transition in terms of the flow of information from bottom up and top down, and we're having a workshop on this next month. So this is a subject very dear to my heart, and I really do hope that one day we will come to understand this scientifically, because it seems to me that I'm a scientist and my job is to try to explain the world without invoking miracles, but by using scientific principles.
Soon
to give up on this.
What about the scientific principle then of design? I mean, is that simply not allowable in as far as you can see as a, you know, as an explanation of the origin of life?
Anything is allowable in science if it's testable, if it's a real explanation. But to say God did it isn't really an explanation, because it just says, well, we can't account for this on the basis of science, so we'll invoke an agent that is itself unexplained. And so I don't see that as a scientific approach. I see it as giving up on the problem. That doesn't mean it's wrong. We have no idea. But I come back to the point that the job of the scientist is to try to explain the world in scientific terms, and invoking an external agent is not really a scientific explanation. It's hard to see how it's testable. The big problem about doing this, you see, is that if somebody said, well, I can explain the origin of life in terms of this agent, and the agent doesn't have to be some sort of super-duper god, it could be some extraterrestrial being, for example. If this explanation would make predictions about if you look for this or that fossil or do this or that evolutionary experiment in the lab, my theory in terms of this agent would predict X, and yours in terms of standard physics, chemistry and biology would predict Y, then you've got something you can test. But I don't think Hugh would be able to give us an example of that sort, although I'd be interested to hear it, Hugh.
Well, Paul, that's what we're trying to do here at Reasons to Believe, is actually lay out different philosophical perspectives and make predictions from, say, a Christian perspective, an atheistic perspective, a deistic perspective, a theistic evolutionary perspective, and try to make the predictions relatively short range, so that we have a reasonable opportunity of determining which predictions are coming true or not coming true, say within a 2, 3, 5, or 10-year time span, And our perspective is let the best model win. And we look at science as being sufficiently robust that it can put to the test these different conflicting worldviews. And so, you know, is God behind it? Is God not behind it? Well, which explanation actually offers a more consistent interpretation of the record of nature that we see? And, you know, I think this is something that we can continue doing for several decades on into the future. But I would agree with you. The way to really advance this is to make short-range scientific predictions that are contrasting. So, for example, you would have, say, a set of atheistic predictions contrasted with Christian predictions, and if they're sufficiently at polar opposites and have a chance of being tested within the next few years, then we could really make some progress. I mean, one thing I presented at NASA Houston was the idea of let's go to the moon and recover the fossils of Earth's first life, because different philosophical perspectives would predict different characteristics in the fossils of Earth's first life. We know we're never going to find them here on the Earth because the Earth's geology has destroyed them all, but we have a fair chance of finding the fossils of Earth's first life on the surface of the moon. So I'm rather eager to encourage NASA to put more focus on the moon than, say, Mars, because I think this could settle a really important philosophical issue.
Well, yes, you're right about those fossils. Unfortunately, they're going to be buried, and it's going to be pretty hard to get them.
Yeah, we'll need that team from that Armageddon film to go and do some drilling or something on the moon to allow that. But it's fascinating stuff. I mean, my mind always boggles whenever I read your books, Hugh, or yours, Paul, or indeed Lawrence's last week, just about the immensity, the scales that we're talking about, but also something that came up last week was Lawrence was almost he comes in almost as sad about the fact that in his view future civilizations in trillennia time in different parts of the universe will not have access to unlocking the secrets of the universe that we have because of the way the universe continues to expand and galaxies shifting beyond the range of our ability to see them, etc. And that we live in this, what he calls a sort of special time, when just at this moment in the life of the universe and on this planet where we have access to it, we can, well, one might say know the mind of God. I'm sure he wouldn't put it like that. But do you find anything kind of compelling, captivating in that idea that is it just a lucky break that we're here at this time, at this moment, on this habitable planet, which is set up so well for discovering the laws of the universe? I mean, do you put that all down to chance, or for you, is that a kind of a question that hangs there about maybe there's more to it than just pure chance?
Well, it's rather a long moment, I have to say. It's some billions of years, many, many billions of years. And also, you must remember that Lawrence is basing his prediction of the very far future on the fashionable notion of dark energy being constant and dominating the expansion of the universe. And 20 years ago, nobody would have said this, and in 20 years' time, we may have a different take on it. For example, if the dark energy weakens over time and eventually goes negative, then the universe may end up collapsing to a big crunch. That's still a possibility. It's going to be very, very hard to discriminate between these things. But I think whichever way you look at it, we've always realized that the universe, at least as we know it, had a beginning. It's evolving. As Hugh has said, it's running down in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics. It can't go on forever. The sun will eventually burn out. All the stars will eventually burn out. So we've known that it's got a finite lifetime. Whether something will go on forever and ever is not clear. But whether or not it does, the conditions in which we find ourselves now, with life-encouraging stars and planets like Earth, is obviously of a finite duration. And so one can wonder about, where do we fit into this great story? Are we somewhere sort of in the peak of the distribution? Are we the only beings here? As Hugh has suggested, the universe might be devoid of other life and other intelligent life. I agree, it might be. I think for me, that's a little bit depressing. Some people find it uplifting. I don't know.
I'd be interested to press you slightly, Paul, on where you stand on this. I mean, a lot of your writing seems sympathetic if you like, to a kind of a purposiveness to the universe, sort of teleology, let's say, of our place and the way we find it. I mean, just to quote you from one of your books, you say, scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have been quietly collecting examples of all too convenient coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life and hence conscious beings to exist. Do you say, we don't know, which is what you seem to have said so far, or do you say, no, it looks like more than chance? You stand on one side, if you like, of that question, of that fence of why the universe is the way it is, let's say.
Right, so pretty much all scientists agree that there's this list of apparent coincidences or convenient features, and the question is, how do we best explain them? And there are a number of different explanations on offer, and one of these we've already referred to is that there's a multiverse and many different universes, each coming with their own laws and special initial conditions, and that in the vast majority of them, these convenient coincidences would not happen, and these universes would go unseen and unlamented, and that we have selected the universe we're in precisely because it's bio-friendly. We couldn't, by definition, exist in a bio-hostile universe. And that's the explanation that most of my colleagues seem to like. I think it's found wanting in some respects, but I don't think it's any worse than simply saying that there's a God who designed it all and made it this way. I don't much like that one either. I think we've simply got to do better. And what I tried to do in my book, The Goldilocks Enigma, was to set out a number of different ways of tackling this problem and put the pluses and minuses for each point of view. I think we're really too limited in our reasoning and in our ways of thinking by simply saying it's a choice between a multiverse or a designer god. I think there are other ways of getting at this. But you see, we mustn't confuse this question about can we explain the fine-tuning of the universe with does it have a meaning or a purpose or something like that. And I've always said it's impossible to be a scientist and not be convinced that there is a scheme of things, that the universe is about something, that when we do a new experiment, for example, like building the Large Hadron Collider, to smash protons together at unprecedented energies, we do it in the expectation that what we're going to find is some sort of rational order. It'll be new, it may be unexpected, but we wouldn't expect to find nonsense. And so it's part of the scientific enterprise to suppose that the deeper we dig and the farther out we push, we still find that there is a rational scheme of things. Now, when you start adding terms like purpose or meaning, you just have to be careful. And I come back to what I said earlier. Humans have purposes and meanings, and other animals do as well, I think. And the question is, can we project that onto nature, given what I've said? And my feeling is that you can do it it's so long as you're cautious. It's an analogy.
Yes,
you project onto nature like we do with mechanism, or the universe is an information processing system like a computer. All of these things are useful. But the ultimate nature of reality may involve categories that are simply outside the scope of anything we've been talking about today. And so what I've tried to do at the end of the Goldilocks Enigma book is to point out that these sort of categories that we might have to deal with are would involve terms and concepts and ideas which not only may be beyond the scope of current science and philosophy, but it may be that our brains have evolved in such a way that they could never really grasp the ultimate nature of reality. And I'm drawn to Douglas Adams' famous computer at the end of the universe, and you know, comes back with the answer 42, which means nothing to human beings. It could be that we could build a machine which is not, which has an intellect which is not the product of evolution, but which is something that that we built, and it could get to grips with the questions we've been talking about and may feel perfectly satisfied it understands them, but could not communicate them.
Could
to
not
us
communicate them,
because
yes.
We don't have the right mental architecture well, to grasp.
Coming back to you, Hugh, perhaps you want to respond there to what Paul's just said. I'd also be interested in your take on the multiverse. Paul says he has some reservations about it, but where do you stand when it comes to the fine tuning of the universe? You, I take it, do see that as a, legitimate evidence pointing towards a design to this universe that we live in?
Well, Paul is right that we astronomers don't dispute the fact that there is fine-tuning in the universe. What impresses me, though, is that the fine-tuning cuts in different ways. As we look at the laws of physics that govern the universe, we recognize that you're not going to be able to bring the equivalent of human beings on the cosmic scene in anything less than a little bit under 14 billion years. Maybe longer, but you can't do it faster than that. And yet, when we look at those same laws of physics and ask the question, what's the maximum time window in which the equivalent of human beings could live in some kind of civilized state, we're looking at it only a few tens of thousands of years. And so we live in a very narrow time window in which our existence is possible. And that's the very narrow time window in which it's possible for us human beings to observe 100% of cosmic history. So if we were placed here any earlier, we wouldn't be able to see the whole story. If we're here any later, we wouldn't be able to see the whole story. And then we look at our geography. I mean, the observable universe has roughly 50 billion trillion stars, but we're living in the one locale where it's safe to launch and sustain high-technology civilization, and it's also the one locale where we're able to see the whole story of cosmic history. And so I see four fine-tuning here in four different levels. We're at the ideal location, the unique location in which we can launch and sustain high-technology civilization. We're at the unique time where that's possible, but that unique time and unique location is also the optimal place and time for us to be able to see the whole story. It seems to suggest that there is someone beyond the universe that wants us to read the book of nature. And as Paul has pointed out, that book of nature is very logical, rational, and consistent. And I think that tells us something about the one that put it all together. He, too, is rational, logical, and consistent. And he has some ultimate purpose in us being here. And as we look out at the universe, we recognize that it was designed to make us possible. It has a purpose, namely to allow for us to exist. Doesn't that imply that we have a purpose as well? And, if I could just comment on the time issue, too, is that when we look at cosmic time, it's one dimension only that can't be stopped or reversed. But that doesn't eliminate the possibility of temporal experiences beyond cosmic time. And this is part of the Christian faith, that before God created this universe of space, time, matter, and energy, he was existing in a temporal state, capable of cause and effect relationships. Indeed, that's where space, time, matter, and energy came from. And, like Paul, I've got some concerns about the multiverse, but I also like a lot about what I see in different multiverse writings that are out there. As I mentioned earlier, some kind of a multiverse is what the Bible has taught for thousands of years, and therefore I think we need to broaden the discussion and say, okay, we recognize that there's reality beyond this universe of space and time. Let's look at the different multiverse options that are out there and see which ones can be tested, which ones can't, and which ones are most compatible with a particular philosophical worldview. So I'm kind of excited about all this multiverse speculation that's going on, because I think it has some real application into putting to test competing theological perspectives.
Yeah, I mean that whole thing that Hugh has spoken of there, Paul, about the idea that you can test with science, using the predictions of science, whether an atheist worldview, a Christian worldview, a deistic worldview, or whatever, that you can use science to determine whether which model is the best. And Hugh obviously is convinced that the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, is best supported by science. Is that a valid use of the scientific enterprise in your view?
Well, science is about coming up with testable explanations, and we shouldn't rule out any particular style of explanation just because it's in or out of fashion. I've never yet come across anybody who is attempting to make a testable prediction of, say, something like intelligent design, and I would be most interested to know about it. But I have to admit that I'm pretty skeptical. But ultimately, it is about testable. An explanation's only good if there's some way of testing it and connecting it to some other body of knowledge. And we certainly know of examples, forensic sounds being the obvious one, where agents are involved, and these are testable hypotheses. Did this person die of natural causes, or who done it? And I think we all recognise that these are valid and legitimate hypotheses that can be tested. But I've never yet come across an attempt to make a scientific prediction based on theism or deism, for that matter, that can be tested in this way. So,
can you enlighten Paul then, Hugh, as to
know more.
to what you're referring to as some of these testable predictions that do support a Christian worldview?
Well, I think Paul's got a point that the Christian community has been remiss in providing a testable, falsifiable, predictive creation model. And that's why we founded Reasons to Believe some 25 years ago, to do that very thing, to build and develop a falsifiable, testable, and predictive creation model. And, you know, I think Christians, too, are remiss on going on university campuses and simply bashing the atheistic or the evolutionary models. We need to have the courage of our convictions and go on the campus and present a positive case for a biblical creation philosophical worldview, show how it can be tested and falsified, boldly make predictions, and then receive criticism from those of, who take a different worldview perspective than we do. And this is something we've been actively doing on university campuses and in our books as well. And I think that's really the way to integrate the scientific enterprise with philosophy and theology, is to do it through testable, falsifiable, predictive models.
Well, I'll tell you what, Hugh, because we're just running out of time, and I'd love to hear maybe one for Paul to respond to just in the final section. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and just give us one example, and we'll just hear Paul's response to it, and then we'll start to draw things to a close. You're listening to Unbelievable, and we're again looking at the universe this week. It's something we like to do every so often. The big questions about space, time, the beginning of life, the beginning of the universe, and today asking, why is the universe the way it is? Hugh Ross with me, founder and president of Reasons to Believe. He, of course, along with Ken Sample, is going to be in the UK for the Unbelievable Conference 2012. And Paul Davies, also joining us from Arizona State University, where he is an astrophysics professor. So join us again, short moment's time, and we'll hear Hugh present Paul with one example of what he believes could be a testable model for testable. Well, I'll let him put it in his own words, because I'm sure I'll fluff it. But be back in just a short moment's time, and we'll hear more on this discussion. Welcome back to the show, Unbelievable. Next week on the programme, I do hope you can join me as I'm joined by David Robertson. Back from the dead, pretty much. He nearly died last year, but, he's well again, thank goodness, and I know that many Unbelievable listeners were praying for his return to good health. But he's back in the hot seat, and he's going to be discussing the Christian faith with the religious antagonist, and we're going to be asking next week, where will antagonistic atheism get us? And I don't know how you conduct your discussions, whether you're an atheist or a Christian, online or in person with people. But we're going to be looking at the particular way that Mike Lee, the religious antagonist, does it via YouTube, via Facebook. He thinks that, being, well, some might say derogatory, insulting, provocative at the very least, is the way to do it. And David Robertson will be in conversation with him about that. Don't miss that next week at the same time. Also, I'm going to be putting out on the podcast, not as a radio broadcast, because we kind of don't have the space for it at the moment in the schedules, but at least on the podcast feed for those who pick up the program that way. Just to kind of complete the circle, really, the William Lane Craig versus Peter Atkins debate that took place at the end of the Reasonable Faith Tour last year. That's been available online for some time now as a video, but I'll post the audio up as well. So expect that in the podcast feed if you subscribe that way to the programme. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. If you don't receive the podcast or you'd like to, that's the place to go to subscribe. You can do it via iTunes, via the podcast reader and that kind of thing. Also next week, just before we finish up today's programme, we will hear the results of a survey that Premier commissioned recently on the British public's beliefs about the origin of the universe. A very interesting set of results, as we asked an independent polling organisation to find out what people believe when it comes to whether God created the universe. Find out the results next week. I'm going to leave it till then because we may see one or two bits pop up in the press about that in the coming week. We'll also hear the reaction of my guest today, who's Hugh Ross and Paul Davies, to those results. And we'll also hear from my guests of last week, Lawrence Krauss and Rodney Holder, what their reaction is to what the British public believe about whether God was responsible for creating the universe. So come back for that same time next week as part of the programme. Right now, time to finish up our discussion today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So, Hugh, bring us an example. We won't have a lot of time to discuss it. So in a nutshell, what one thing that you think does, as it were, provide evidence for the Christian worldview that gives a testable prediction that is in contradistinction to other worldviews?
Well, I mean, one thing I talk about is how, you know, if you see a coin being flipped and it comes up heads 1,000 times in a row, you can say, is that the product of pure chance, or has the coin been designed to come up heads? And what you would do is you'd look at both sides of the coin and, you know, make some testing of its weight and its distribution and make a determination. We can actually do the same thing with anything within the record of nature. And so something we've been interested in is actually looking at the universe, our galaxy, and solar system in more and more detail, and see if the fine-tuning evidence grows with respect to time or shrinks with respect to time. A Christian worldview perspective would predict that it should increase with respect to time and increase in a fairly dramatic way. Earlier I talked about how we could go to the moon and find the fossils of Earth's first life. We have evidence that Earth's earliest life actually was exported to the moon on low-velocity collision events, which means that they should exist in pristine form on the surface of the moon in a fair abundance level. And, different models on the origin of life predict different things about what those first life forms on planet Earth should look like. So there you got contrasting predictions. Let's go to the moon and see who's right and see who's wrong.
And just for those who maybe aren't sure what you're driving at there, Hugh, what are you saying should we predict on a biblical worldview?
Well, you know, what I've been hearing at Origin of Life research conferences is that Earth's first life would have to be orders of magnitude simpler than the simplest life we see on planet Earth today, that the life forms should be very tiny, that we should expect that it would be one species only. I mean, when you look at a biblical perspective, it makes the point that God is packing our planet Earth with as much life as possible, as diverse a life as possible, for as long as the laws of physics would allow. So we would expect that first life would date very early in terms of Earth's history, that it wouldn't be just one species, that we would see an ecology, and that we'd be looking at fairly complex unicellular life forms, not things that are orders of magnitude simpler in terms of their size and their chemistry. And so let's go to the moon and see what we find.
Well, it might take a bit of funding to get that project underway.
Well, it'll be a lot cheaper than going to Mars.
Which is something I think you've recommended as well, isn't it, Paul? But Paul, what do you make of that then? I mean, what do you make of Hugh's idea that you can test and compare, you know, predict what we should be finding? And then if we find it, we say, well, yeah, the biblical worldview wins out over a naturalistic one, let's say.
Well, I was wondering what Hugh was driving at with the fossils on the moon, but I now understand. So let's just make this absolutely clear that, Hugh, you're saying that in at least your interpretation of the biblical or Christian worldview, life ab initio is a riot of rich complexity of many, many organisms, but presumably unicellular or multicellular, you think, right from the word go?
I'm saying unicellular. After all, we can trace life back on Earth to about 3.47 billion years,
right.
And we notice that all of life at that point is unicellular. It's what we'd expect because the conditions of the early Earth at that time wouldn't permit the existence of multicellular life, And so we're talking life at 3.8 billion years, which the isotope evidence indicates that's when life emerged on planet Earth. We wouldn't be looking at anything more complex than unicellular. On the other hand, from a biblical perspective, it's like God is being as aggressive as possible, given the laws of physics he set up and packing the Earth with life, and therefore we would anticipate that it would be more than just a single species, and it would be a species of unicellular life that would be as complex as what we see in the simplest life forms on the Earth today. So, I would argue, too, that not all Christians agree with me on this, and so we're kind of looking at these predictions as a way not only to test different models outside of Christianity, but different models inside of Christianity. So we kind of look at the scientific enterprise as being robust enough to actually put to the test conflicting models, say, within a fairly narrow spread of a Christian interpretation.
It's a fascinating project, if it could ever happen, you know, to make that, to look at that. What's your response, just briefly, Paul, and then we will have to finish up.
Well, look, it's a neat idea. The practical problem is, first of all, that, as I mentioned earlier, that the moon is not totally inert. There's a process called gardening where what happens is that meteorites hitting the moon churn up the surface. And so Hugh's absolutely right. There will be early Earth material on the moon. There's no doubt whatever about that, but it's very hard to get at and identify. But the more serious problem, and I know a lot of people involved in this field of paleobiology, one of the world's experts is just coming to visit me in an hour's time from Australia. The difficulty is that the biomarkers that you might want to establish species diversity degrade over time. Even on the moon, it would be very, very hard, I think, even if you found microfossils, to be able to identify the organic material in them with enough fidelity to say these are from different species. It's a really, really tough one. But, it's an interesting point that Hugh is making, and I very much welcome the fact that this debate, which has sort of got bogged down in recent years, could be moved along by coming up with some specific testable examples.
I think it's a very interesting approach, isn't it? It breaks it out of the usual arguments a little bit.
I think all scientists have to agree that if a hypothesis is testable and makes certain predictions, then it becomes part of the scientific process.
Well, it's been fascinating having you both on, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. Hugh, any last words as we just start to wrap up this program, as we've been asking the question, why is the universe the way it is?
Well, I think what we're hearing is that science is a robust enterprise, and let's, with all our gusto we have, pursue these issues. And this is a great way, too, to get the public involved in this. I mean, they're deeply interested in how science can be used to test different worldviews.
And, Paul, anything to add as we conclude?
Oh, I think these are all fascinating questions, and it, for me, projects me back to that wide-eyed schoolboy staring up at the sky, wondering what was the meaning of it all and what is my place in it. And I just think it's marvelous that I've had an entire career engaging these sorts of issues, and that we've discovered an awful lot more about the universe since. But some of these big questions are still nagging at us, and that's why we can have fascinating discussions like we've had today.
Well, keep that schoolboy questioning going, because it's always provides fascinating reading material and listening material. So if you want to find out more about Paul's work, as I mentioned, I'm putting links with the podcast of this program, and you can find out more for yourself, get yourself a copy of some of his latest stuff. Hugh as well, of course, available there at the podcast, the Ministry of Reasons to Believe, and some of his work, and of course details of how to see him in person when he comes to the UK Saturday the 26th of May. Hugh will be one of the keynote speakers at Unbelievable, the conference 2012. Going to be giving you some more details as ever about that as we move towards the latter part of today's program, and hear some of your responses as well to last week's programme on the universe. For the moment, though, thank you, gentlemen, both, for being with me on today's show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as I mentioned, we will actually hear again from both Paul and Hugh, and indeed Lawrence Krauss and Rodney Holder of last week's show on whether we can get a universe from nothing, as they respond to some interesting survey results on what segment of the British population believe that God created the universe. That's to be revealed on next week's show, and you'll hear their responses to it. For the moment, if you want to get in touch, as usual, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Lots of people have been emailing in on last week's show. I'm going to read some of your emails in a moment's time. Also, you can get in touch, obviously, via Facebook, via the Twitter account, @UnbelievableJB is the Twitter, and Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the page where I just post up updates on the programme and little interesting bits from around the internet. But a lot of conversation actually going on the newly formed Unbelievable group. I'll mention that on next week's programme, because the nature of the conversation over the last 2 weeks has been quite interesting to see in the whole area of antagonism. But if you like forthright debate, that's certainly a place where you'll find it between Christians and atheists. So why not check that out as well? Just type in Unbelievable group and you can request to be added, and you will be added by one of the moderators. Thanks to the individuals who have volunteered themselves to help moderate as admins that group, which is a pretty full-time job, to be honest. But anyway, some of your feedback to last week. Well, here's a show regular, Peter Byram, who says, if I were writing a sitcom about the great God debate, Lawrence Krauss would need virtually no adjustments. It was cringeworthy to hear him try to redefine something, i.e. physical laws and entities, as nothing, i.e. the absence of anything, which is what has always been meant when people ask, why is there something rather than nothing? His audibly impatient tone of conversation served to further indicate that his agenda was anti-God rather than pro-truth, though he did, in fairness, confess that ultimately he didn't want to be judged by the great cosmic Saddam Hussein. Furthermore, he had not learned from his debate with William Lane Craig what a necessary being is. His response to the Leibnizian cosmological argument from contingency was just as uninformed on your show as it was this time last year. In addition to which, he also didn't seem to have learned or remembered from that debate that the probability of the stars being arranged to spell out I am here is vastly more probable than the fine-tuning itself. So by Krauss's logic, he ought to believe in God as the basis of the very evidence he's bending over backwards to explain away. But the absolutely killer comedy punchline came when Krauss, at his most exasperated, shouted, "Philosophers know nothing!" Well, according to Krauss's own definition of nothing, presumably that means philosophers actually know something. And one of those somethings might just be the knowledge of how to identify fallacious reasoning, such as the equivocation Krauss constantly uses on the word nothing, and his ad hominem dismissal of his critical reception in the New York Times as being written by a philosopher instead of a scientist. The irony would be hilarious if not for the more ominous truth that this man's media exposure makes him a genuine threat to the very reason and education these new atheists claim to be champions of. In summary, Krauss has nothing of substance to say. Thank you, Peter. Michael Funder says, if I may, just finish listening to Krauss Holder on the beginnings of the universe. To have a show on an evangelical radio station that is so open to debate and honest questioning is truly amazing. Thank you very much, Michael. You say, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks to the heads of Premier for letting you do it. In my humble opinion, there is too much thought police and doctrinal ideology in evangelicalism, and too many people in the pews willing to put up with it. I'm a Christian and don't believe that natural theology has the ultimate answers. But the opposite extremes appear to either be to submit a priori to the fiats of doctrine, or to end up with a non-committal type of woolly liberalism. Please excuse the labelling and simplifying the very things you work against on your show. Thanks again for hosting it. Long may it continue. Thanks for emailing, Michael. Tim Boyle out in Kobe in Japan says, fabulous show. I'm really looking forward to this week's. Having graduated from Arizona State University in physics long before either Lawrence Krauss or Paul Davies were there, it's great to see such thoughtful and provocative input coming from my old alma mater. Both Krauss and Holder gave good accounts as to why they believe what they do. But one point that was raised by Holder, kind of in passing, is something I think should really be emphasised in this debate over why there's something rather than nothing. In order for there to be anything at all, there has to be something that is a brute fact, something that is eternal and uncaused. The question then is whether that uncaused first cause is a non-physical mind or a mindless physical entity of some sort. Likewise, we must ask ourselves which of those two general possibilities has the best explanatory scope and power in explaining the empirical facts we can observe. One's reading of the continually expanding evidence is often determined more by one's philosophical worldview than by a pure follow the evidence wherever it may lead openness. And the anti-theistic worldview of Krauss seems to me to close him off from one of the two possibilities before he really gives the possibility a fair hearing. I have to admit, though, that the wishful thinking kind of position that many theists seem to take can be viewed similarly. So is this forever going to be a standoff? Neither view can be proven in an absolute sense, and so in the end, an element of faith is required for either position. But which faith is really rooted in reality? The Christian worldview is often portrayed as blind faith, and for some it perhaps is. But I see that label as more applicable to the atheist faith. Keep up the good work. Here's Sebastian says, if there's an infinite number of multiple universes constantly branching off, presumably there must be universes where Jesus wasn't crucified, took a wrong path, or maybe didn't even exist. A parallel problem which seems to be answered by a Christian cosmologist is in regard to sentient life on other planets. Did Jesus on Earth die for them too? Suppose their civilizations predate Jesus. Did they have an incarnated Messiah before they shed their bodies and became disembodied minds, which I figure might be the end game for consciousness? Always fascinating, Sebastian, the tangents your emails go off on, but thank you. Yes, ET, extraterrestrials, we did actually cover that in the previous program that Paul Davies was on the program for some time back, which I'll link to, of course, with today's podcast. Paul says in Chicago, Paul says, great show as always on Krauss and Holder. I'm responding to it. I'm not surprised Krauss has gotten so much criticism for his book in that he, like Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow, throws philosophy under the bus while then engaging themselves in extremely bad philosophy. I'm basing this solely on his discussion on your show, as I've yet to be able to read the book. He go on to talk about the fact that, the equivocation of nothing and what nothing really is. You also say, chiming in with what Peter Byram said earlier, Dr. Krauss, Dr. Krauss also displays his lack of understanding of philosophy by not understanding the concepts of necessity versus contingency. Apparently, he's not even familiar with Gottfried Leibniz, pronounced Leibniz, according to you. You want to inform Dr. Krauss, and also apparently doesn't care about his ignorance or philosophy. This is a basic problem with Krauss and many other scientists these days. They lack an understanding that was much more common in earlier great scientists like Kepler, Boyle, Newton, and others. For example, Krauss posits a multiverse and admits that it is in the realm of metaphysics, which is to say it's a philosophical claim or belief, yet seems to lack the understanding of this fact. When one lacks an understanding of philosophy and logic, then one is bound to make logical and philosophical mistakes. But who cares what they say? We act as if they're authorities about something. They knew nothing, Krauss says. And he didn't do very well against William Lane Craig. I doubt he'd do any better against Leibniz. Or Leibniz, however you pronounce it. Martin Plowboy is a young earth creationist, was very unimpressed with the show. Says, I've just listened to the debate, and while Lawrence Krauss knew what he was talking about, the woolly spiritual moron from the Faraday Institute had not a clue. Of course we know how the universe was created. God tells us how in his word, the same place he tells us about Jesus. So how Rodney can say that he believes in a Jesus and not notice that this Jesus also believed in what the Bible says about creation is beyond me. Lawrence was completely right. He didn't have a leg to stand on and convinced no one. Doubtless your conference will be similar with the reasons to believe folk who will fail to provide any reasons. The previous program had a similar failing. You're referring to the gay marriage program there, with no evidence that the Christian had actually applied biblical teaching to the argument. Well, Martin, I appreciate you obviously hold a very different view to Hugh Ross, who was on today, and to Rodney Holder of last week. There is a spectrum, as it were, on the Christian's view of science and creation. You're obviously a young earth creationist. Just to perhaps pacify you a little, Martin, on that front, we're responding to the many calls we've had for some kind of a young earth versus old earth creationist. And just so you're clear, Hugh Ross is an old earth creationist, believes in an earth that's millions of years old. doesn't believe that contradicts, and a universe that's billions of years old, doesn't believe that contradicts the biblical account. We're going to be doing a debate on that, and members of the public are welcome. It is the old earth, young earth creation debate, really, of the year, I would say, at Gunnersbury Baptist Church. We're asking, do we live on an old or a young earth, and does it matter? Now, this exciting event, I'll be chairing that. Thanks to Gunnersbury Baptist Church and Lawrence Truett there for hosting it. Monday the 28th of May, so that's the Monday after the conference, okay? If you can make it, 7:30 p.m, Gunnersbury Baptist Church, completely free. And we're going to be putting Hugh, Ross, and indeed Ken Samples on the one side as the old earth creationist team, as it were. And they're going to be facing off against Andy McIntosh and Stephen Lloyd. Stephen Lloyd has been a guest on the programme before. Both young earth creationists, Andy McIntosh with very much a science background. Stephen Lloyd also with a science background, but he's a pastor, will be bringing more the theological objections to an old earth creationist view. So that should be a fascinating debate, I'm sure you'll agree. And I hope you can turn up for that. More details I'll post with this podcast about that at the Gunnersbury Baptist Church website. But the basic details are, get yourself along to Gunnersbury Baptist Church Monday the 28th of May in the evening. For if you're interested in those issues, that will be really the defining debate, because Hugh Ross is generally seen as the premier proponent of an old earth creationist view in the world. And if Answers in Genesis or anyone else are responding to something, they'll be responding to Hugh Ross on that. So he's very happy to defend his position there, and we're going to be hearing from the young earth creationist position, and I'll be doing my best to moderate that debate fairly. So hope you can get along to that. I've hardly left myself any time for more of these emails. There are lots more people emailing on Lawrence Krauss and that. If you want to respond, as usual, you can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. So I hope you'll book in right now for Unbelievable, the conference, just 3 weeks away, Saturday the 26th of May. Great speakers, wonderful sort of day of seminars, teaching, Q&A. Looking forward to meeting lots of people there. premier.org.uk/reasons. And don't forget, some of those side events going on are in sort of the week around it. Hugh and Ken at Gunnersbury Baptist Church in debate with Young Earth Creationist View. And we've got them going out to some churches on the Sunday. I'll tell you about that next week. If you're in the area of some of those churches, you might be interested in hearing them preaching. Coming together, a debate at Imperial College against an atheist. Hugh Ross will be doing that. So it's kind of still a work in progress at the moment, but that's going to be on the Thursday night, Thursday the 24th of May. Get yourself along to that if you can. I will be able to give you full details next week on that. And the Church Leaders Brunch. Church leader, are you a church leader? Get in touch with me. I'd be interested to hear if you'd like to come along to a Church Leaders Brunch with Hugh Ross and Ken Samples on the Friday the 25th of May here in London. So that's all for now. Thank you for listening. I'll see you again same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
David Robertson will be here, and he's going to be interacting with the religious antagonist, Mike Lee, as we ask, where does antagonistic atheism get us? That's next week on the programme. In the meantime, have a great week.